I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. The suicide deaths of fashion designer Kate Spade and celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain came as a shock to their fans. Mental health professionals have raised concerns over the potential for what they call a contagion effect. They also say that publicity around the deaths can also prompt people contemplating suicide to seek help. Joining us to talk about that today is psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning to you both.
Hi, Mindy.
So, as I mentioned, some mental health experts are concerned about what's called contagion suicide. So what is that?
Well, what it means is basically just what it says, is that when somebody, especially somebody famous that we've always looked up to, loved, admired, kills themselves, that opens a door to people that might be contemplating or thinking along those lines or feeling very dark. It opens a door because here's somebody who is valuable but has decided to end their life. And here I am, very unvaluable, of no value. Why can't I do it? It diminishes the fear a bit about killing yourself. And that's one of the components. Killing yourself is hard. Mm. It's 'cause we're wired and evolve millions of years not to do such a thing, preserve our life and keep our DNA going forward. That's evolution. So it's a basic instinct that you go against when you do kill yourself. So it's a hard thing to do. So when you see somebody who is famous, admired, who takes this act, it diminishes your fear about it, and you can identify with the person, because that's really what we do when we hear about somebody like this. We identify and imagine ourselves in their position. They might have money, fame, etc. And why would they have done that? You know, and we also, the other piece of it is that we think about the details of their last moments. When that's publicized in great detail or repeated in the news, that is one of the thought to be one of the encouragements toward contagion. Mm-hmm. Because knowing the details, you can kind of get into it. And if you are susceptible or vulnerable, you can start to identify with that. And it becomes more possible, mm-hmm. I guess, is the bottom line.
Well, I think it's important to understand that the conditions by which suicide happen are because of a thought disorder. You're not thinking correctly, and there are multiple causes for thought disorder. But basically, people aren't thinking straight when they decide to kill themselves. They're not thinking straight when they decide to kill someone else. And suicide and homicide are just different sides of the same coin. So quite often, people who are suicidal will go out and commit murder and then maybe kill themselves or try and commit suicide by cop or something like that. So it's a complex situation, and it's not linked to so-called mental health issues. There are some people who are more vulnerable, but anyone can have a thought disorder, either long-standing or temporary, and it doesn't actually quite fit the criteria for any so-called Access 1 or Access 2 diagnostic workup. So it's much more prevalent than people think about. And as Mark says, one of the big triggers for contagion is publicity, mm-hmm. and media loves to publicize sensational things because that's how they sell newspapers. And I don't think you have to be a psychologist or psychiatrist to figure out how irresponsible it is to broadcast the deaths of people and in the headlines announce they've committed suicide, and in the headlines of the article tell exactly how they were found and mm-hmm. some of the details. Those are the two findings that are illustrative of how irresponsible media can sometimes be. And even some major papers like the New York Times and Washington Post have made those grievous errors, you know, mm-hmm. and they normally ought not to do that. In better times, they didn't, but now they seem to be falling back. Maybe it's a change in editorship. But it's a very important aspect to remember. The more you publicize it, the more you create copycat killers. Mm-hmm. Just like there can be a copycat killer of a serial killer, there'd be a copycat killer of someone who wants to kill themselves.
Sure. But on the flip side of that, there's also thoughts that suicide hotlines report increasing numbers of calls following news of a celebrity death by suicide. Day after Robin Williams died, the number of calls in Boston doubled. Mm-hmm. So there are some that are saying this news can also encourage people who are thinking those thoughts to seek help.
It could.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very
not
good
everybody
point.
Who is exposed to suicide, you know, commits it, even if they have thoughts about it. That is not really a trigger. It is a trigger for some people, but it's not a trigger in general. A lot of people have thoughts disorders and think about killing themselves and have suicide, and they never act on it, never, ever.
And it's not just the amount of publicity, it's how it's publicized, too. In 1989, it became apparent to psychologists and media people that maybe we're missing something here. So they drew up some guidelines. Guidelines included some common sense things like maybe not even use the word suicide in the headline, but just say that somebody died at such and such.
You don't put the method of death in there either in the headline. You don't do that. Mm-hmm. There's another guideline they have on that.
That's right. And then avoid description much of the details of how they killed themselves. Because there are statistics that show after some deaths by suicide, by hanging, that those kinds of suicide deaths bumped up and increased.
You know, you might remember some people who were listening, and I remember this, the death of Kurt Cobain.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I remember reading the notices in the newspaper, and it took me quite a while to figure out how he died.
Yep. You know, well, that's because he died after these guidelines, and they were followed pretty much
in
his death. For him, they were followed, and the suicide rate did not increase, and even decreased some in Seattle. He apparently was from Seattle, because they not only followed these guidelines in terms of the publicity, but they also initiated some suicide prevention methods.
Yeah. I think the way we, as you're saying, there are some media who are more attentive to that than others. In the 80s, I actually did a series on suicide, and we actually had a psychiatrist come in and work with me on the series because I was so afraid. Like, you know, you hear, well, you don't want to talk about it because then you're going to, you know, prompt other people to do it. And she was saying, no, that's not true. But I had her read over every script just to make sure the language was correct. And because it's a big responsibility.
Well, not every media outlet takes their stuff that responsibly, unfortunately. So that was the right thing to do.
Yeah. All right. So when we have these celebrity deaths, do you think younger people are? Is it all ages, or are younger people more at risk than or it just is individual? Depends on the person.
Well, you know, younger people are more at risk depending on the generation. And young kids now, 15, 16, and under, there really seems to be an increasing kind of epidemic of young girls especially, and so well as some boys who are actually verbal and describe themselves as being depressed and have thoughts of suicide, and without knowing how normal it is to sometimes think about that, they use that to convince themselves that they're more depressed than they are. And instead of seeking treatment, a lot of time the parents don't seek treatment for the kids, and the kids are left wondering what they should do next, and they think that there's no solution. There's a solution to being depressed. There's a solution to having suicidal thoughts. These things are not, these are not final exits. These are just parts of our normal life. So we do have more young kids who are more susceptible to that. And social media, Facebook, has played a role in causing, you know, terribly negative self feelings for people, and also deaths.
Sure. Yeah, and the statistics do support just what you said, that the I believe it goes that in the general population, the number of percentage of people that have had suicidal thoughts is around 5%, something like that. And with high school kids, though, it's around 8 or 9%. So it is a population that is more influenceable, if you will, and more their emotions are more intense than and they have less ability to have a perspective on their life than others that are older and mature.
And for parents, I mean, I think it's tough because, you know, when you're looking at changes in behavior, teenagers, they can be moody. They lock themselves in their rooms. And, you know, all these things that we would think of as signs of potential problems are kind of normal for a lot of teenagers.
That's right.
Well, I'm not really sure I would say it's normal for a lot of teenagers. I think certainly changes in behavior are consistent with growing up, but I'm hesitant to say any kind of behavior that is a change in behavior is normal for kids. I think any change in behavior that parents notice they really should have that checked out. And the worst thing that can happen is you get sent home and people say, nope, everything is
they're
okay. Because I would rather do that than err on the side of saying, let's ignore what.
Yeah, don't ignore it. Yeah. But there is a hard differential commenting on. Yeah.
So baby boomers, are they the greatest risk of death by suicide?
Now they are.
Okay. Now they are.
And now we are, I should
we
say.
We are. We're it.
Mm-hmm. Speak for yourself, Mark.
Right. Definitely. There's such a, especially in more recent years since the financial crisis in 2008, there's been such changes in our economic stability and even our general sense of stability in more recent years that the baby boomers are indeed more vulnerable. And there's a lot of theories about it, particularly the white male baby boomers are the vulnerable group. The theory there is, blends with why Trump is president and why he got on that bandwagon of Make America Great Again. In other words, give power back to the people who have lost it, who have been left behind, the ones that didn't get the college education, but were blue-collar workers. And it used to be that blue-collar workers could really succeed very well and live a very comfortable middle-class life. It's much harder now. And the economy keeps changing. We no longer rely on brawn to make a good living. It's more brains. That's quite a shift. So yes, the white men who thought that just by being white they were entitled have been displaced, or they've had a much harder time. And it's interesting, blacks and Hispanics do not have a high suicide rate as whites do. In general. Mm-hmm. This goes along with that, where, you know, blacks have a sense of brotherhood, perhaps because they have been so persecuted and put down for so long as part of their life. So they have a better sense of belonging, if you will. Same with Hispanics. It's the alienated white male that is seems to be statistically the more vulnerable individual in our society today.
Yeah, it's true that some of the interesting research is coming out of behavioral economists that try to have causative links between a decline and an individual economic strength and stability, leading to more suicide. So as you are losing your ability to make the kind of money that you want to make or think you need to make, quite often older white men in baby boomer generation, they seem to not have had enough adversity earlier in their lives to develop kind of coping skills to deal with the vicissitudes of crazy things happening in their lives. Mm-hmm. And so they're old. They may have some medical problems, but the financial problems is certainly a contributing factor to make them think there's nothing left for them. So they really need to get more coping skills. And it is the financial burden is taking a big toll on the older white guys.
Yeah. And that's not to say that we're all money grubbers, really, you know, and that's why we kill ourselves, because we can't get enough of it. Having wealth is a basic force in life in order to have survival and to have status in the society. We use money as a measurement, but it really does reflect a basic human need.
Certainly in America, that's true. I'm not sure it's in other cultures. That's not true. I don't think
they have
certainly
better, right. Yeah. And have better social nets.
Right. Yeah. And I think the other thing with baby boomers is how many are living alone. You were talking about, you know, being connected and feeling that sense of brotherhood or you know, part of they're alone, lonely, sometimes living with some kind of chronic pain. Right. Looking at the cost. I mean, the cost of things, health care, bankruptcy rates, all of these things. You could see where somebody kind of feel like, desperate.
That's
right. Again, and also they are being precluded. I think it's right to say they're being precluded from access to health care. And they don't have access to psychological health care, psychiatric health care. They don't have the referrals. They're not aware that in Massachusetts we still have great coverage no matter what insurance plan you have, but they're not aware that their insurance plan will cover any kind of psychological, psychiatric help. And furthermore, some of the behavioral plans, some of the medical plans don't have high enough reimbursement rates, so a lot of clinicians are no longer taking some of those plans. So you get this new plan that your boss decided to pick for the company, and then you go and try and find a provider. You cannot find a provider that is on the panel.
The system makes it hard.
The system makes it very hard,
And you sort of touched on the role of social media, but, you know, with the, and, you know, I know the younger kids are not on Facebook, but we older folks are still using the Facebook thing. But I can understand where people feel more lonely looking at Facebook, like, look at all these people having these fabulous lives, and, you know, my life isn't like that. And it's really, it's fake.
Sure.
You know, it's not real.
Sure.
That's correct.
So what role does social media have in all of this? I mean, and I guess, like, with the celebrity deaths, it used to be, you know, as you read it in the newspaper, and as you were saying, Mike, it wasn't always in the headlines, so you kind of have to go into the story. And young people generally didn't read that deep into the newspapers, and so maybe they didn't even know what happened. Where now it's all over social media, and there's all kinds of things that are said. Some may be true, some may not. So I would think that would play a role in all
this. Well, my experience with the kids that I work with is that they really are avid consumers of what we would call, what our generation would call news, except they don't get it from newspapers. You know, their newspapers are all the BuzzFeeds, Instagrams, you know, sharing on Snapchats and stuff like that. If they're friends, they are very up-to-date on what's going on. Regrettably, they're also very up-to-date on the conspiracy theories going on. When Triple X was just killed the other day, there's already a rumor going out that he's still alive. And as evidence, for example, someone will point out to a video that he's saying, I'm not dead, I'm alive. Well, just for those who are listening, that was done several years ago in response to a music video he made in which it appeared to have died in that music video. Once he realized that, he came out with a video saying, no, I'm not dead, it was just a video. And now people are using that. So the problem is they're not good consumers of understanding there are no time stamps on what you receive from the internet. Right. If I have a paper newspaper dated today, well, I know what's the story is current or 2 years ago. There's nothing like that. You really, really, really have to dig out the timeline on the internet, and kids just don't do that.
Yeah, we had that when we were kids. Remember, I buried Paul. Paul was supposed to have died in the car accident. Remember that?
What? It was like, you mean he's not dead?
He's not dead. And the Elvis, the sighting, Elvis sightings. Elvis sightings.
Yeah. Sure.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of suicide with psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So even those not contemplating suicide can be rocked by the kind of news of the celebrity deaths, like the recent ones we just had. And we often feel like we know these people, we look up to them, and in some cases it feels like we had a death in the family because we're connected to that.
A lot of people felt that way about Anthony Bourdain.
For sure. Yeah. And especially he had connections here in the Cape. He started in Provincetown. So it can, you know, trigger the same kind of, you know, maybe depression we would have if somebody in our family died.
It's true. You know, people look at TV shows, your favorite TV show, think of anyone that you liked. You know, we all identify with our favorite character, and even if they're irascible, we think the best of them. If you see them on the street, you think they're the character they portray, and it's very hard for people to differentiate between an actor playing a role, which is scripted and has direction, you know, given to him and a lot of support, and the individual who plays that role. And a lot of people, actors, rebel against that. They say, I'm not a role model, don't copy me. But of course, media, just being in the front of a TV camera, being beamed to millions of people, you are automatically a role model, just like sports figures and sports heroes are. And no matter how much you say, no, I'm not a role model, the matter of fact is you are. You are a reluctant role model, but there's nothing you can do about it, except try not to mess it up.
Yeah. You know? And in Anthony Bourdain's case, it wasn't scripted. I mean, he was himself, you know.
In a show,
so you really do feel like you know him because he's being himself and, you know, happy. And, you know, so this really comes as a shock to
his family. I wonder if Kate Spade's passing has effect, affected him and made him decide to do something.
Because
I have not read anything about him having plans before that, even though he was thinking about it for a very long time. So he may be the most famous celebrity example of contagion.
Yeah, cool. We'll never know, I guess, on that. The other fact, average rate of suicide on the Cape and Islands is 2% above the state average, and that was from 2010 to 2016. But that kind of seems, those numbers seem to be pretty much accurate most of the time. Why do you think that is? What's
I think anyone who is driven in traffic in the summertime. I think the reality is that Cape Cod, despite what people in the rest of the world may think, Cape Cod is really a depressed area. You know, it's very difficult to live here, very difficult to live on the islands in the wintertime. You know, year-round is very different from the summertime. And there's a lot of pressure here. It's very difficult to pay your bills. It's very difficult to get one job to pay for housing and your bills. And some people have to get two or three jobs. It's even worse on Nantucket. So I think there's a lot of, again, financial pressure that we talked about. And if you feel that you're not being successful, kind of the thinking you have is maybe you might want to end it. Instead of a more rational thought, which is, let me see how I can solve this problem, which might in fact include moving someplace else, even if just a little bit over the bridge.
Yeah. The other thing is you have to acknowledge the population on the Cape, largely retirement age.
Baby boomers.
Baby boomers that are in retirement age, which is the time of less connection, especially in our society, more aloneness. Drinking alcohol is a big factor, and there is, I think, a little bit higher rate here on the Cape, if I'm not mistaken. I think we even had large numbers of the opioid problem, opioid deaths here on the problem. All speak something to the people here, as well as the geography and all the factors that you just mentioned. But certainly elder suicide is definitely an issue. That's one of the risk factors, if you will.
Let's talk to Jean, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Good morning, Jean.
How are you?
Good. Hi. How are you?
Okay. Last year, my 58-year-old husband killed himself.
I'm sorry.
Appreciative for all the information that people have been talking about lately. But I was wondering why it's never addressed what's left behind. I have two adult daughters and my husband's sisters, and we have been in some kind of strange haze, and we have a hard time getting out of it.
Yeah.
And I just don't know if anyone realizes how you feel after that happens and how it lingers and lingers. It's one of the most painful things, I'm sure, that my family and I will ever go through. And though I seek out all kinds of help, I still feel that it's actually not there, especially here on the Cape. He actually killed himself in Maryland, and this is where he raised our kids, and I took one of them and came back here, and I can't find anything. I just can't find something.
Yeah, Jean, thank you for bringing that up, too. And I'm so sorry about your husband, but this is something we want to talk about, the aftermath. I mean, because when it does, it impacts an entire family.
Well, of course it does that.
And a community.
And a community, right.
No, we can hear it in your voice, the pain. And that is simply goes with that territory because it's such a painful thing. It's so complicated, sources of the pain. It's not just the loss of the person. You certainly have that. But you also have questions about, well, what role did I play in it? You know, all the what ifs. Didn't I love them enough? Didn't they love me enough? It's a major betrayal.
But I got to tell you, there's nothing for you down that road. You have to stop yourself from thinking those
thoughts. Right, but I'm just talking about the questions, the gut feelings that arise after something like that. It's just naturally human to have these feelings. As a therapist or a psychiatrist, I've had patients that have died, and I've gone through some of the same feelings, although not the same extent that Gene has. that is part of the connection, part of the, and it's a more painful loss than just an understandable, quote, understandable death.
And also, Jean and the family members and people who knew her husband, they're also going through the grief and mourning period that you go through through any loss. And this is exacerbated. It's clinically, you might say it's a complicated grieving. But in addition to trying to answer some unanswerable questions, they're also going through a grief and mourning process. Right. And sometimes that could take years to go through. Other times people go through it rather quickly.
I want to ask Jean. Jean, you mentioned that you've been seeking out some help. And I'm imagining support groups. Have you looked to see if there were support groups of other folks in your similar situation?
I did, and one support group that they used to meet here in Falmouth at the hospital, they no longer meet there, and there's one, I believe it's out in Chatham, which is, you know, kind of a long way to go, and the other one is up in Kingston. Mm-hmm. I do go to a private therapist, but when I was in Maryland, I went once to a group, a support group, and it was really pretty helpful. And I worry about my daughters who can't even go to like a firework. He shot himself. So they hear that all the time and they can't function very well.
Sure. Yeah. I'm surprised that there wouldn't be a support group in this area any longer.
Especially at the hospital, I can't imagine why they would stop it.
Yeah. Jean, you might want to ask them if there are other, when they stop that one, you know, at the hospital, ask them if they know of other ones, because it seems like that, I mean, there are certainly the numbers that could benefit from that. And I'm surprised as well that
Jean,
group.
Jean, can I ask you, have you felt any avoidance by other people because of this experience? In other words,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's such a painful thing that I imagine you felt like you know, you have a contagious disease or something that people want to leprosy or something that people want to
People think that somehow it's contagious. They're going to catch it somewhere.
Or that they just don't know what to say.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's a very hard thing. And
Jean, do you have any advice, for example, how maybe somebody might approach you and talk to you without, you know, worrying about saying the wrong thing or making you feel worse? Any advice you can give to any listener?
Well, I think that the best thing that someone has said to me or to my daughters or to my sister-in-law is that they kind of just say, I don't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that, instead of trying to give advice, because that's there's no advice that they could possibly give.
Right.
So when they say that, you know, they don't know what to say, or, you know, and you can see that they're compassionate, mm-hmm. and they don't walk away, because I have lost some friends. I never heard from them again. And I don't know if it was, and it could be because they didn't know what to say.
Right.
But I would hope that they could step up to the plate and be brave.
Yeah. Jean, thanks so much for sharing your story and your feelings with us.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
All right.
Dave is calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Mindy, Mike, and Mark.
Hi there.
Good morning.
Good morning. I was intrigued by a comment before about white males feeling disenfranchised, and I wonder how much of our maybe social thought disorder is due to our attitude toward money as a be-all and end-all, mm-hmm. instead of toward our careers and the activities that have intrinsic value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to say, when you're at like a cocktail party, it's not last like, hey, what do you do for fun? It's always, what do you do? Who are you?
That's an East Coast, Boston kind of stuff. Other states, they don't. You know, California, you really, you know, there's not the same kind of ethic we have here. But certainly, as Mark and I talked about, money is quite important for some people for a couple of reasons. Psychologically, people have a relationship with money in their earning capacity, just like they have a relationship with another human being, just like alcoholics have a relationship with their alcohol or there are other substances that they abuse. So the people do have a relationship with that. And if your relationship with money is not very healthy, you have a disproportionate way of leaning upon that and a different kind of perceptual calculus that you use to judge your own kind of self-worth. People who have a more reasonable attachment to what they do have a more understanding that they should be more attached to people and not to money. But on the other side, there are some people who feel more comfortable dealing with work issues because you can solve a work issue. Really hard to figure out some relationships because relationships are so messy and complicated. So I think it's a couple of those two things going on.
You're right. It's harder to address, talk about, accept the aspect of social connection in your life, the relationships that are meaningful or are difficult. That doesn't provide status, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Socially, we're always driven by how we look to others. And money is a simple way of calculating that and providing some kind of value. But the value of life is not money. It's really how you connect with others and how others connect with you, the meaningfulness of it all, as you can just have heard in Jean's mm-hmm. painful voice as she described what she so traumatically lost.
Yeah. Dave, thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking about, Jean brought up the question of aftermath, and, Jean and her daughters. I'm thinking when you're a parent and you have a child who dies by suicide, oh. I mean, that aftermath also, you have yourself going, why didn't I see the guilt of why didn't I see this? Could I have stopped it?
Absolutely. Yeah, that is exceedingly painful. I've seen patients that 40 years later, the pain is just as it was a day after. So intense. They've gone on about their life, perhaps, but the emptiness, the hole, is so significant when a child commits suicide. It's awfully hard to cope with. I've dealt with suicidal people fairly commonly. And one of the things a lot of times I ask them about their ideas about it is give some consideration to the people around you. What if somebody mm-hmm. important in your life had done this? How would you feel, et cetera, mm-hmm. In order to get them to see a little bit more realistically and pull them out of the narrow vision that they have, which is what a suicide is. The person is just so narrowly focused on their pain and the need to relieve it is probably the most common thing, that they discount the effect of others on mm-hmm. others,
yeah.
As if it isn't as if it's okay because yeah. they're so pained.
Well, and a lot of times I'm thinking when you're talking about elder suicide, well, I'm a burden to my kids.
That's
you know,
right.
I'm doing them a favor. And in reality, that's not
no.
the case. Yeah.
No.
Your thoughts on that, Mike?
Well, it's extremely painful to sort of lose a child. And again, you are faced with inexplicable questions that you feel a need to answer. And there's really no answer to any of them. But one of the most difficult things to confront is the fact that other people may exactly talk about their children. Oh, my child is doing well. My son's doing mm-hmm. this. And you're thinking, well, my kid is dead.
Mm-hmm. And yeah.
And certainly you don't really say that. You don't want to say, oh, yeah, well, my kid is dead. You're not going to say that mm-hmm. because that makes the other people feel so much worse and they don't realize they blundered into this horrible kind of area. So a lot of times when your child leaves like that, you're left wondering, what is my relationship to other people and their children now and how do I position myself? What kind of facial expression do I use when they're talking about their kids? How mm-hmm. do I respond without feeling like a hypocrite and mm-hmm. also without, feeling the need to honor my own child because they accomplished so much and I love them so much? So it's a whole different set of complications. And you would think, well, how could it be more complicated than surviving someone who committed suicide? Well, when it's your child who's committed suicide, it is much more complicated yeah. like that. As anyone who's lost a child knows, it's much more devastating, if that's possible, than losing someone else.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk about prevention and treatment after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of suicide with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before we talk about prevention and treatment, I was surprised. Humans, not the only animals to die by suicide.
Yes, that's right. It's very interesting. It happens across the animal kingdom to some extent. Bumblebees, for instance, have been shown and have been studied, and they commit suicide. For instance, as a guard against parasites, so that if one of them, let's say, is infected, or some are infected, they will kill themselves to save the rest of the nest. Then there's the example of P. aphids, which I guess are little bugs that infect peas, pea plants. They have a suicide bomb mechanism where they will ward off predators by emitting this, I guess it's some kind of gas or chemical, that does kill them, but it saves a greater number. And the same thing with lions. Some male lions have been known to expose their neck to an attacking pack of competitive lions so that the rest of the herd can get away. So, there is something inborn about sacrificing yourself for the greater good that is wired in some way in our evolution.
Of course, in our case, it's not for the greater good.
I think I have a different viewpoint that I'd like to put out there for the people who are not Republicans in our listening audience. The idea is that I think, as our studies in the mole rats indicated, that this is for self-preservation for the species.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's not so much committing, you know, the bumblebee wants to kill himself for a particular reason.
Yeah.
It's so the greater species would survive.
Right.
Far different kind of heuristic than like an individual killing themselves.
Right.
They kill themselves, as we spoke about before, it's all individual, all about
them.
They're not thinking about the family, the community, stuff like that. So
yeah.
I don't want people, policymakers who might be listening, thinking that we should like, okay, well, there's an example in the animal kingdom, so
let's follow that.
Right, yeah, good point.
All right, let's talk to Patty, who's calling from Barnstable. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I'm listening to what you're saying, and you're asking people to get help. Well, I've been trying to get a new psychiatrist just to give me scripts, and the wait here is about 4 months.
Yep.
And it's not because I haven't been trying, and I just want to get my medication. For people who really have problems, I'm always hearing, well, all you have to do is this and this and that. But when you get down to the reality of trying to get this help, it's so different.
Yeah. You're right, Patty.
Yeah, but we have an expert right here.
Yes.
Comment on that.
Not only an expert, but I've recently retired my clinical practice, retired from it. So I've been going through these kind of machinations with a number of people trying to find dispositions or other forms of treatment, and it is indeed very difficult. First off, there's a shortage of psychiatry and mental health professionals nationwide. It's especially bad in rural areas. We are a rural area. It's especially bad on the Cape and has been for a number of years. There are agencies and organizations that do exist. A lot of them at this point have ridiculously long waiting lists on the order of what you just said. Alternative, and it's a good alternative, is nurse practitioners. Advanced practice psychiatric nurse practitioners are nurses. Usually they've had experience as a psychiatric nurse, and then they go on to get further training and get certified by the state. So they can prescribe all the medications that can be prescribed. And there are a number more of those than there are psychiatrists. Yes, you need to struggle. You need to look, and you might have to go off Cape. It's much easier in certainly in the metropolitan area, I wish there was an easy... Question.
Patty, have you tried the community health centers? Any of the community...
Yes.
Sometimes, especially I know the community health center we have that's here in Falmouth and Mashpee, because they're integrated with mental health and, you know, the primary care docs. And they do a really great job.
Like Mark said, they don't have a staff of psychiatrists on this.
They don't have enough.
They do have some.
They have psychiatric nurse practitioners. Yeah. The other big organizations are obviously Cape Cod Healthcare, a very large outpatient practice. On the Outer Cape, it's the Outer Cape Health Services, and they have they do have these services, but they're hard to access because they don't have enough staff. When I started referring people to Cape Cod Healthcare, they were taken in fairly quickly, but after a few months, they lost one psychiatrist, for instance, that was treating some 600 patients.
Wow.
So all of a sudden, they have to have alternatives for those 600 people. Now the patients that I refer there are told that they have to wait. One stopgap measure is to make an arrangement with your primary care doctor.
That's going to be my next question.
And I've arranged that for a number of my people. A number of my patients that I've had to refer is I communicate with the primary care doctor so that they know that they're just perhaps doing this on an interim when the patient has a complicated condition. But a lot of times the conditions are not so complicated and can be managed.
Well, Mark, can you comment on the fact that some people will go to the urgent care center or the ER?
That's not a bad idea. Okay. I would definitely do that. And that also actually plays the game a little bit. It pushes you up on the waiting lists, especially at Cape Cod Healthcare, you're part of their institution, and you're not just a name that called in. So I would urge people to do that.
And do you think Cape Cod Healthcare has a lot of clinical nurse practitioners? Because I don't know if they have a special department.
Oh yes, they do. Okay. They do, and actually, I've been on the Cape some 25 years or so. Now the organization at Cape Cod Healthcare is much more responsive and much better staff than it ever had been in psychiatry. Plus, they have the organization, what's called the Accountable Care Organization. And in principle, psychiatry is very much part of the medical care delivery system and is integrated in it. So, if you will, the organization has the pledge. They've made the pledge to address these needs. I think as time goes on, unless the funding drops out for this, which it certainly can.
Patty, good luck. I hope that was helpful to you. We have an email from Louise in Barnstable. She says, I have a 7-year-old son who, having very emotional outbreaks, sometimes says, I should be dead or I'll just kill myself, etc. It's very distressing as his mother to hear these thoughts, and I worry about whether he will follow through, especially in his teen years. Any advice? Am I being too focused on this?
No, I don't think so. I think you should find a child psychologist and have the family attend some sessions and get a diagnostic workup about that. But just because the child is saying that at 7 or 8 years old, that does not mean that they're going to do something in 2, 3, 5, 10 years.
That's not a big predictor, but it's a source of concern right now. Something is troubling this child.
Well, I can say that happened with my daughter, although she was seeing a therapist at the time. And when she said that, the advice I got was, well, it's because of your reaction to what she's saying. And so the next time she said it, I said, oh, really? How are you going to do that? And she said, with a nail. And I said, ooh, that's going to hurt. And I walked in. She never said it again.
Okay.
But, you know, you want to make sure there's nothing else going on.
Sure,
right?
It's not.
Yeah. All right. And then we have Lee, who says, this is a different slant of suicide than you're discussing. 55,000 American died in the Vietnam War. And since that time, way higher than that number have committed suicide.
Oh, yes.
By the late 80s, it already doubled. And I don't know where that number is now.
Around 40,000.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Upwards of 40,000 per year.
Can I just mention one thing to Patty? If you do continue running into a roadblock of psychiatric meds here, consider Jordan Hospital in Plymouth, and also a lot of people never consider Providence. It's the same distance in Boston, and they got a boatload of hospitals there.
That's right.
So the two other things to consider if the push comes to shove.
It's not convenient.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about prevention and treatment. So I think we've talked many times about some of the risk factors you see, with kids. You see change in behavior, or same thing with adults, you know, isolation. What are some of the things we want to be looking at as far as, you know, helping folks get help?
Well, you want to listen to what the individual saying, child or adult, if they're talking about wishing they were not here, thinking that it's better off without me, stuff like that. You'd want to assess that. You want to, just as a parent or spouse, ask them, well, what do you mean by that? What's going on? And ask them very clearly, and ask them to explain what's going on. And if the answer that they give you makes you think, well, I don't like the sound of this at all, then you have to call someone to get someone in.
And it's okay to ask them, are you thinking about suicide? Is that okay to
ask?
It's
okay to ask them that, and it's okay to ask them exactly what do you mean by that. I want to know what exactly are you saying. And if you have to assess the answer. But if your assessment is that I don't like the way this is sounding, you have to find a way to get them into treatment. And we have more psychological care professionals than psychiatrists, so it's somewhat easier to get into a counseling, so-called counseling session, but you want to go with someone who's experienced. If it's a child, someone who understands kids, they're not just little adults. If it's an adult, someone who knows about suicide and, you know, depression and stuff like that, what might be going on. But you should get that checked out professionally. And I have to say, pediatrician is not always the way to go. PCP is not always the way to go. They really don't have the specialized training. They may know someone they can refer you to. It's okay to ask, but don't rely on
just... Ask your pediatrician.
Don't rely on their assessment as being the only one.
Okay. But just to echo the importance of talking about it, you want to diminish also, in talking about it, you want to diminish the shame. By talking about it, you can diminish the person's shame about having those ideas. And that's one of the things that keeps people secret and actually can smooth the way to a suicide by keeping it in.
You make that clear. Make clear what you're trying to say, because I think it may have come out the wrong way. That if you talk about it, it makes it smoother for them to kill themselves.
No. You want to diminish the shame. The shame can drive somebody to act.
The shame can
drive. Secret.
By taking what they're saying seriously and not overreacting, that is the soothing aspect, the therapeutic aspect of a family member. Yeah.
That you acknowledge their pain. Suicide thoughts, I've always thought of as a indicator, at least in my profession, as the depth of a depression, just like an internist will look at a fever. Fever is tells you something is wrong with the body, and it's just a symptom of the condition. So with depression especially, which is so often associated with this phenomenon, the presence of suicidal ideas just indicates the depth of it, and is a just like I say, like a thermometer reading. It's not something to be ashamed of, because it simply is a symptom of it, and it goes with the condition. One of the sayings, if you will, or aphorisms that is said is that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, kind of concisely says that, or indicates the state of mind of somebody who is depressed. They don't see any other way of living, and that the way they feel now has to go on forever. That is clearly a distortion.
That's the thought disorder that you were talking about.
Yeah, we got about a minute and a half. So treatment, what are some of the treatment options?
One of the best treatments is cognitive behavioral therapy. There was just an article in the New York Times, I think a couple of weeks ago, about cognitive behavioral therapy. And even after 30, 40 years, it seems to be a well-known secret, a badly held secret, rather, that people do get benefit with the cognitive behavioral therapy. It works with schizophrenia. There's research out there for bipolar and suicidal depression, all that kind of stuff. And also part of it should be a pharmacological aspect, if that's helpful, too.
Sure. No, you want to treat the underlying condition, if there is one. Yeah. Cognitive behavioral therapy is an excellent tool on the psychotherapy end of it, the talking end of it. Yes, it's very direct.
And then the last, 45 seconds we have, Don't take this lightly when you think something's wrong with somebody's having some trouble. You want to talk.
Don't isolate, is the thing.
This is a treatable condition. This is a treatable. There's a solution to this.
Absolutely.
All right. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychologist Michael Abruzzese, here the third Wednesday of the month. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.